Okay, hi, good evening. So tonight we'll continue from the previous 3 weeks. And let's talk about something, okay? So we spoke that we are going to now focus on the Shita, on the approach of Rabbi or Professor David Weissel Livni. And his issue was that he is a believer on something called scholarship kipshuto. The idea is that whenever you learn a Gemara, he always tried to find the original intent. And when the Amoraim explained each other, when the Gemara comes to give an interpretation, the Gemara is trying to actually understand what the statement meant in its original form, right? We all know that this is called originalism. There are different forms of original intent, or thorough intent, or originalism. We know that Scalia in the Supreme Court was a big believer of that, at least on originalism. And his view is that whenever the Gemara comes to explain something or to answer Akasha, the Gemara is trying to actually understand and explain what the original intent of the original author was. And then it was stuck because the Gemara has so many times something called Terutzim Dchukim. Many times you have very forced interpretations that doesn't make sense. And the question is, why and how did it get to be? And this became actually his lifetime work. He actually, Professor David Weissel Livni wrote, he's still working on the Shas, but he wrote a running Pirush on the Shas. It's called Mekorot Mesorot, it's called Sources and Traditions, and always addressing the issue of Terutzim Dchukim. I'll show you the first sugya that I'm aware of where he dawned in an approach to solve the issue. Let's look at the sources. Source one, Mishnah. The Mishnah says like this. Mishnah is in the beginning of the 8th Perek in Gittin. If a person throws a get, a divorce, a bill of divorce to his wife, and she is in her house or she is in the chotzer, it's get. In other words, you don't have to give it into her hand. As long as you throw to a place where she's standing at, that's enough. Says the Gemara. I mean, the Mishnah says, and she is in the house. Omar Ula v'yushomedet b'tzad b'ita. Ula says, the obvious thing, if the Mishnah says that she is in the house, means that she has to stay at least next to the house, u'b'tzad chatzera. Raboi she'omer. Avshoisha says, no. Even though the Mishnah says that he threw the bill of divorce and she was standing in the house or she is staying in the courtyard, afilu b'tvere v'chatzera b'tzipori. Even if she was in Tiberias, and her and the chatzera and the courtyard was in Sifris, in Tzipori, very far away, it doesn't have to be next to it. He b'Tzipori v'chatzera b'Tver b'Uresh. It doesn't have to be there, as long as it's her courtyard or her house, she doesn't have to be there. Okay, so that's my argument. Ula and Rabbi Ishia. Ula holds that you have to be in the chotzer. Doron says you don't. So the Gemara asks the obvious question. Ve'ayi betoch beita. Now, if you look at the question, okay, interesting. If you pay attention to the Gemara, the original argument is attributed. You know who the argument is between Ula and Rav Hoshea. And it says, what language is the language that's used? It is Hebrew. Now there is something called the anonymous question. One second, how can you say, according to Rav Hoshea, that she doesn't have to be there? The Mishnah is explicit. The Mishnah says, if somebody throws the bill of divorce to a lady's, to a woman's house, and she is in the house or she is in the courtyard, how can Rav Hoshea say, she doesn't have to be there? So, Achi Kamar, the Gemara answers the following. V'hi kimi shebetoch beita, v'hi kimi shebetoch bechatzera. The Mishnah doesn't mean to say that she was there. It's as if she was there. In other words, if he throws the get to the house or the courtyard, and it is as if she was there, that's okay. The cave and the chotzer mishtameres ledaitahi, because we're talking about a courtyard or a house that's being guarded or that's being safe kept by her, he mitgareshet, that's enough. Doesn't have to be physically there, as long as the place is being kept under her auspices. Interesting, this question and this answer are, number one, anonymous. Number two, what language is it? It switches from the Hebrew to Aramaic. And the big question is, why doesn't the Gemara ask the Rabbosha? The Gemara, there's an anonymous question, an anonymous answer, that doesn't even address Rabbosha. This is a question of Rabbosha. You should have asked Rabbosha, hello, one second, what are you saying? You're telling me that she doesn't have to be there? The Mishnah says you do have to be there. The Gemara is an anonymous question, an anonymous answer. And not only that, what kind? This is a typical terutz tachug. That's a forced interpretation. The Mishnah says if you throw the get and she's there, Rabbi Isha says she doesn't have to be there. So an anonymous question on second, the Mishnah says she does have to be there. The anonymous answer is she doesn't have to be there. It has to be as if she was there. She has to be virtually there, like a virtual reality Mishnah. This is how the Mishnah talks. And this was the place that he got stuck. He says, one second, this doesn't make sense. So in his original Mekorot Msorot, it was published in 1975, right, Nashim, he came to the conclusion that, you know something, there was a break in the communication. The Mishnah says if he throws a bill of divorce, a get, to her house, vehi betoch beita, and she is in the house. This word vehi, probably Rabbosha didn't have that in the Mishnah. The reason why Rabbosha holds that she doesn't have to be there is because this word of vehi is a girsa in the Mishnah, is a variant text. Ula had it, and Rabbosha didn't have it. Because you could read the same Mishnah and saying, Hazorek get lishto betoch beita. He throws the get betoch beita, and he says, okay, betoch beita, that's to be there. The word vehi is a variant. But the anonymous question, when it was asked to Rabbi Yoshia, and the people who asked the anonymous question had the gears of vehi. So then they had to explain, and to say, one second, how can Rabbi Yoshia say that she's not there if the Mishnah says that she's there? So they were stuck with a question. Rabbi Yoshia wasn't there anymore to ask. So they had to force an interpretation. Better a bad teretz than leave the question open. So he says, but the real reason of Rabbi Yoshia is not that. The real reason Rabbi Yoshia holds that she doesn't have to be there is because the word vehi is not in the Mishnah according to Rabbi Yoshia. And this was his eureka moment. There was a break somewhere along the line that we are using a Mishnah that we have to ask Rabbi Yoshia a question on a text that he didn't have. And therefore, this is because the Gemara was written over process of time. So that's why the traditions, why that's why it's Mekorot u Mesorot, sources and traditions got broken. Because the source, when it went to the tradition, the broken phone line happened. Now, when he did it, at that original time, 1975, people went crazy. One second, you tell me that you know about Rabbi Yoshia better than the Gemara knew? The Gemara could have said that. The Gemara doesn't say. And who are the people? Why didn't they say that? So they told him, try to find a text that doesn't have the word vehi. You tell me that Rabbi Yoshia had a Mishnah without the word vehi, which is very elegant, because if you take the word vehi is completely independent. If you take it out, the Mishnah makes sense. Show me a Mishnah without the word vehi. So he is a huge bokeh. And he found that if you look at the Rishonim and Rashi in several places, he quotes the Mishnah without the word vehi. So you see that maybe some Rishonim had the Mishnah without the word vehi. So the word vehi, now, you could say the Rishonim had the word vehi, but he doesn't have to go ahead and to cite the entire Mishnah. He only cited part of the Mishnah. Halivni, and they gave him a lot of heat on this one. But luckily enough, in one of the variant, we know that we have, there is a great project. If anybody wants to see, today is available on the web, it's called Gnazim. You could go to the web and see side by side, which is called the synoptic versions of all the manuscripts that we have in every daf. Luckily enough, he found one manuscript that does not have the word vihi. So you see that there was a possibility of a Mishnah without the word vihi, and that's the Mishnah of Rabbi Yishael. And this was his eureka moment. And his old Pirush is saying, the Terusim Tchukim came to be because they didn't have the original person who spoke. They had to find the Terutz, and sometimes the Terutz wasn't obvious. They give a Terutz like a placeholder. Now this caused, as you could imagine, a humongous problem. Because what, you're trying... The old is not very old. The manuscript that we have, we're going to talk about manuscripts. So the manuscript is, I don't remember what age, but for sure is not after the 9th century, before the 9th century. We don't have, as you're going to see, the late 8th century, the 9th century is the oldest that we have. Even though there is one, perhaps, manuscript of Hulin, who perhaps some people say would be earlier. As you see, the tradition is that this is nothing earlier than the end of the 8th century, beginning of the 9th century. And clearly this one wasn't. So, now, Halivni said that, and he becomes like this. That's why this caused, as you could imagine, a rebellion. Imagine, you're going to start saying that the Gemara didn't understand itself. There was some kind of a break. And he was at that time at JTS. Now, Halivni is a very interesting person. He was at JTS once I asked him, because he's a very frum person, and he's a true Yerushalayim. I think he's a real Yerushalayim. So what was JTS? Listen, JTS was a great place because it was a university. Was basically, he said like this, JTS had two sukkahs, two sukkot. One sukkah that had metal things holding because they weren't machmir on mamidim, and the other sukkah to be machmir like the Mishnah Brura that you couldn't have mamidim. So in other words, you had for sure the sukkah was kosher, but people wanted to be machmir like the Mishnah Brura, there was a kind of a sukkah. Some people want to be maker like the other achroinim had a different sukkah. So the idea is was very much of a university. It was sponsored by the conservative movement, but wasn't conservative movement. People were religious. I told you, people were there who were machmir and the Mishnah Brura not to use mamidim. But, and that's why you had Reb Shaul Lieberman and other people who were Yerushalayim. So they felt, now, the JTS evolved more as a, almost like an arm of the conservative movement. And that's why in 1983 was the big issue about women being accepted into the seminary. And the idea of the women being accepted to the seminary caused Halivni to actually leave. In 1985, he leaves JTS because of it. Because then he realized that JTS, at least that's what he tells me, JTS becomes a arm of the conservative movement and basically became a political issue. That now you want to accept women and you find the reason why it's acceptable, why it's okay to accept women. And he said that was not the seminary that he was used to. The seminary that he used to, they would ask a shayla, they would go ahead and research the halacha. They would be more makel because they were of the view that as long as there is some view out there that allows it, it's okay. But here, the women's issue was that they came to them, which basically a fait accompli, we want women at the seminary. Now find us a heter. And he felt that this violates what the seminary was all about. Now there's all the issues out there, and he leaves in 1985. And when he left, he said, I'm going to quote what he summarizes his feelings, why he left the seminary. He says like this, "It is my personal tragedy that the people that I davened with, I cannot talk to. And the people that I talk to, I cannot daven with. However, when the chips are down, I will always side with the people that I daven with. Because I can live without talking, but I cannot live without davening." And that's why he left the seminary, and he decided to open UTJ, and that was a whole development. And this is when he leaves, and he joins Columbia University, actually 1986. But I'll tell you something that I even asked him. So Gershon Scholem asked Halevi, and he says, how can a modern critical scholar be so conservative as to reject women from JTS? Meaning you're such a machmir? You're saying that the war made so many mistakes. And Halivni told me that you don't understand, he tells Scholem. He says, there is such a thing that he believed himself, that he combined critical methodology with a full commitment to halacha. And he says like this, there is such a thing called Torat Chaim, and there is such a thing called Torat Emet. Torat Chaim is how you have to live your life. How you live your life is halacha. And halacha, there are rules of halacha of how to develop. Even though perhaps they were using forced interpretations to come out to halacha, that maybe they missed the point, but it doesn't matter. As long as Klal Yisrael accepted it, that's Torat Chaim, and that's how we live as Jews. But we have an obligation of Torat Emet, of looking at the truth. And the truth is a critical truth. And when you go in a critical eyes, that today we have so many tools, that you look at, you know something? Chazal had this assumption. They assumed that the Mishnah read the same way to Ula and Traboisha. Today, if you do some critical reading, you realize that the Mishnah didn't have one text, had variant texts. So when a critical scholar, you realize that the emet is that you could have come into a different eretz. But that would never change the halacha. So it's interesting that Halivni, Professor Halivni, and I've seen him enough times, he keeps halacha, his son is machmir in every single chumrah that you could imagine. Because it doesn't matter. The halacha is the halacha. Hashem gave us a way how to practice halacha, and that's how the Rabbonim decide, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us siyata dishmaya. But there is a critical scholar can learn and to know how it came out to be. And he could have done something else. And this becomes his raison d'etre, finding the truth, the alternative path of how things became the way they are. So he believed they were, in essence, some kind of a break in the transmission, like here the Mishnah. But this is only Halivni, because he believed that the Chazal were looking for the original intent. But if you go ahead, like we have understood, and the Gross says that so many times, we do not subscribe to the idea of original intent, originalism. That's a Christian idea. And the Jewish idea is that we could always give a reinterpretation, something called applied meaning. As long as there is, and now, how do we, and which means, let me just, in the Mishnah is, Chazal understood that when the Mishnah says that she's standing by the chotzer, if you look in a conceptual way, it doesn't make a difference if she's there, as long as it's under her control. Being virtually there or physically there is irrelevant. You're right, the Mishnah might be talking that she was there. Raboisha says, you're right, but I'm going to reinterpret the Mishnah that the key determinant is not being physically in the chotzer, but being virtually in the chotzer, conceptually in the chotzer. Conceptual reality is the same. And this is something called applied meaning. And I'll tell you, the question is, Derrida, if you know that all the deconstructionists, to say one second, if you apply meaning, so then there's no original meaning. It's a party. Anybody can do whatever they want. So the answer is, as we all know, there are two schools, even on constitutional interpretation. But the truth is, the Gros and the Maral talk about this. The Gros says the only way to do it, to apply a meaning, is a meaning that can give something called the integrity of the text. As long as the meaning is something that fits with everything else. It has to be a meaning. If you want to apply meaning, you have to make sure that you know kol ha'tera kula, that the applied meaning fits everywhere else. You cannot close, plug a hole here, creating 50 holes there. That's why Reb Chaim Volozhiner said that every time the Gros came up with a pirush, it felt that it was true in every level of Torah, including Kabbalah. That's called the integrity of text. And if you know, in the Reader's Interpretation School of Thought, Hans Gadamer is the one who believes that. The other one is the Maral. The Maral says the only time an applied interpretation flies is if the community of scholars accept that. You need communal acceptance, not acceptance by vote of people who never opened a Gemara, but the community of scholars. And if anybody knows, that's Stanley Fish. Stanley Fish, in his famous book, is there a text in this class? He says, the way how you create a control in the Constitution, if you want to apply meaning, if the community of scholars are okay with it. If you have a applied meaning that passes muster with the people, it works. So that's the idea, but Halivni didn't believe that. Halivni believed that, for some reason, the traditions got broken. And he comes to ask, how did that happen? And then he comes to realize his famous finding. And you realize that the Gemara is divided into two texts. Here, the sugya is very clear and obvious. Part of it is in Hebrew, part of it is in Aramaic. Part of the Gemara is attributed, you know who's talking. A big part of it is anonymous. You realize that the anonymous part of the Gemara, besides being in Aramaic, next to it, it uses a very limited terminology. You could put like 200 pages, it's like Yiddish. No, you never see Yiddish in yeshivas. If you go to yeshivish Yiddish, you go, and my son said he goes to go ahead to listen to Shiur in Yiddish. He doesn't know Yiddish. But you learn Yiddish in yeshivas exactly in 2 weeks. Why? Because they use 200 words, and those 200 words are just the same 200 words in Yiddish. That's it. It's not like the fiddler on the roof in Yiddish, which yet you have to know the dach is a roof. It's much harder. You need translation. But in yeshivas, Yiddish means yeshivish Yiddish, means 200 words. The stoma, the Gemara, is the same. So he realizes that the Gemara has two strata. One of them is called the attributed, and the other one is the stam, the anonymous. He came to realize that if you look in functions, they are very different. The Amoraic statements, the attributed statements, are always Amoraim, always in Hebrew, and they are very definite, very concise. As you see here, right? Toch beita, and the other one says, afilu hibetzipori. It's very clear, it's very terse, it's very definite, it's a halacha. He came to call this apodictic. Apodictic is a terminology used in studies of Christian texts, which apodictic are rulings. Definite, very terse, very clear. And they are in Hebrew. If you look at the stam of the Gemara, at the anonymous part of the Gemara, it's very different. A lot of the interpretations are forced. You're like here. In other words, you ask a kasha, there's a great kasha, and to get away with the teretz, you give a teretz, which sometimes is very forced. Many times there's no clear tradition. It's very tentative. It's not very definite. If you look at the Moraim here, the Moraim give you a very definite statement. The Stama doesn't. Not only that, the Stama is discursive. Okay? It's a interpretation. It's a question and an answer. While the Moraim attributed in Hebrew and very definite. And he says, very funny, why doesn't the Stama ever ask the Moraim? You just ask Akash on the Mora, how can you say that she's standing far away if the Mishnah says that she's standing next to it? So the Stam, or this anonymous question, is asked, but the Moraim don't answer. The anonymous voice answers. Why don't the Moraim answer? So he realizes that the Stam of the Gemara is very, very, very different. So he came out to his Eureka moment. Was not only printed Nashim, was actually printed his second volume. In the first volume, when he had the Kasha, and he said, you know something, Raboisha had a different version of the Mishnah. For some reason, the anonymous voice didn't have it. Good. How did he get there? Until he had this Eureka moment when he printed his second volume. And he said, you know why? Because they are not living at the same time. they don't live, they were not contemporaneous. The Stam, the Gemara, that Stam is later than the Moraim. That's why they couldn't ask them. That's why the questions, and he says, you know why? And he comes out to the conclusion that the Moraim, when they preserved their teachings, they preserved the teachings like the Mishnah, which means the Mishnah is like the American Constitution, that you have the ruins, but how did he get there? The deliberations, the discussions are not there, are not preserved. So he came out with this idea, the following, that the Gemara was preserved in the same way like the Mishnah was preserved. And there were people who preserved those traditions. They are called the Tanaim. The Tanaim, not only they were Tanaim, as I mentioned to you, they were people with a phenomenal memory. The Gemara quotes that whenever you wanted to check a brisa, who did you call? You called the Tanaim. And the Tanaim were people with phenomenal memory. As I told you, Abshol Liber Manoi says, people have a phenomenal memory, but they were very dumb. The Gemara says, on the Tanaim, Tanei Tana Veluyada Mekomer. The Tana repeats, but doesn't know what he's talking about. They wanted people who did not know much, because otherwise they would go ahead and decide to, quote unquote, better the text. As I mentioned to you, the translation of Shakespeare in Yiddish is verteicht und verbessert, is translated and improved. So they didn't want the improvement on Shakespeare. So they said, okay, let's get a guy who's very dumb, and he's going to have a good memory. But he says the Amoraim also were preserved. The deliberations were not preserved. They were kept in the memory. They are called, in Halivni's terminology, Sridim. Sridim is what's left over. Sorry to call it. They were left over that the people remembered. Says Halivni the following idea. And this is how he comes to the end, okay, of his development. I told you his books kept developing, because this is a theory. So as long as he wrote Shas, he wrote his interpretation on Shas, and his theory was evolving until he comes out to the final theory. His final theory is the following, that the Moraim, when they learned in their own circles, and they kept preserved this idea with the Tana. The discussions, the arguments, were kept informally, the called Sridim. When the Moraim finished the work, there were people who came who decided to put and to preserve the discussions, the arguments, and deliberation. And these people are called the Stamayim. Halivni says the Bavli is a reverse engineering done by the Stamayim. And the Stamayim were the people who lived after the Amoraim. When the Amoraic work was finished, they decided, you know something? We need to preserve the deliberations. We need to preserve the arguments. We need to preserve the questions. And they didn't have all the answers. Some people remember, some people didn't remember. And they had to reverse engineer and construct it.
Relate to Rabbanan Severoi?
So we're going to talk in a second. So Halivni makes up a new category of people called Stamayim. This way he became known as the Stamayim. I remember the first class I go to Halivni. I remember going to Columbia University. And he's talking about the Tanaim, the Amoraim, the Savoraim, we go to the Savoraik, which are mentioned, the Savoroim are mentioned by the Pshira Goyen, and the Stamayim. And I screamed, Stamayim? Who ever heard of them? Meaning, I learned Hashem Shas and Orish. There is no such a thing as Stamayim. These are people that you made up. He says, they were there. They are the unsung heroes of the Bavli. These are the true anonymous people. He found a whole category of people. And his view of the Bavli is the following. We know that the Bavli has Amoraim that go afterwards, the post-date Ravashi. The last of the people mentioned in the Gemara by name is Rav Revai Merov. You should remember, Rav Revai Merov, somebody who the Pshira Goyen says lived for a long life, he passed away around the year 560. Okay, in the year 560, Rav Revai Merov passes away. Halivni's view is the following. As long as the Moraim were there, they kept the Moraic statements, the rulings, the final conclusion like the American Constitution. And he calls this the apodictic law. Apodictic law, I told you, a term used in Christian studies. Afterwards, the Stamaim, these quote-unquote anonymous people from the year 560, decided, you know something, we need to keep the deliberations, because otherwise, how are we going to find out? So they had to reverse engineer to collect from people who still remembered. Why didn't they ask ever the Moraim in Halev Nisvi? Because they were after the Moraim. So there was nobody to ask. And they reconstructed the sugyot. They built the sugyot. Because you realize that the anonymous part of the Gemara not only creates a deliberation, it frames the sugya. It puts it in context. But this is anonymous. And this is a reverse engineer by the Stamaim. And his view, the Stamaim went. This is, I'm giving you the first, last idea. From the year 560 until the middle of the 8th century, to be precise, the year 730, give or take. Why did he get to the year 730? Because he has to fit in the Saboraim. What are the Saboraim? The Saboraim are the ones who came afterwards. So he just fits in between this Stamaim, who worked for a long time, from the year 560 to the year 730, 170 years. They built the Bavli. They are the unsung heroes of the Bavli. They created the Bavli. You take the Stam and the Bavli is a bunch of statements. They are the unsung heroes. And who are the Saboraim? Saboraim are the ones who basically concluded the Talmud. They basically made the sugyot into, we're going to show you how they did the process. But who were they? They are the first people who wrote individual works after the Bavli. You know, it's fascinating. We Jews write books without any limits, right? We know that we are called the Ahlal Kitab. And if you look, Lahavdil, Muhammad called us the people of the book because we keep writing books. Yes, exactly right. But they were original Jews also. But the Ahlal Kitab, it's us, right? We print the books. Can you imagine? We have like, try to, in Eretz Yisrael, right? We have, everybody prints a book. I think that you have the Mishnah Brura with the Chayodom, and you have the Chayodom, today somebody put it with the Mishnah Brura. Understand? Like people keep printing books. And you know what's amazing? During the time of the Gemara, from the time of the Mishnah, from the time of the Gemara, the beginning, year 220, to the year 780, for 560 years, we don't have one book written by an individual. The first books to come is the Sheiltot, Baravacha Meshabcha, okay, and the second, third of the 8th century, around the year 770, and the Alachot, Psuk, Alachot Gdolot of Rav Shimon Kaira. The Alachot Gdolot of Rav Shimon Kaira. Those are the first individual works. And then everybody starts writing. So there was this huge gap. He says that Shimon Kaira and Ravacha Meshabcha, they are the ones who decided to conclude the work of the Stamaim. They are called Saboraim because they basically tightened the work of the Stamaim who reconstructed the Sugyot, and they put all of that reconstructed work in a book format. So, according now, give a second. So he calls like this: the work that was done by them are called the Mitzarfim. Remember all these words you have in your called the Mitzarfim. They are the combiners and the compilers. They took all the Stam of the Gemara, they put it together, they created Sugyot, they combined it, and many times when they finished it, they found something else afterwards, they put it as an appendix. Because many times you see the Sugyot have appendices, and I showed you before. According to him, is the year 730 to 770. If you look at your, and you have, I prepare for you, if you look at the little handout from before, you have exactly the timeline on page 10. The Amoraim, the combiners, okay, this is originally combining the Amoraic statements, that the originals, the Stamayim, and then the compilers creating Sugyot into a single Talmud. They took all this Stamaitic work and the Sugyot combined, put it into a book, compiled the compilers, and that was done by the Saboraim, and then they were the transposers. After they did that, they cross-referenced the Shas, because if you realize the Shas is full of cross-references. If anybody pays attention, it's fascinating. The Bavli is full of cross-references, right? They are sugyot muavarot, meaning Chazal say that they were sugyot taken from there, that means cross-referencing. So this is the uptime. From the year 730 to 770 are the compilers, the Saborim, the transposers. That's it. And this is the work that he says by these unsung people called the Stamayim. And that's why the Stamayim are the ones that are so different. That's why they don't talk to the Moraim. That's why they are forced interpretations, because they didn't have the Moraim to ask from. And they are the ones who created something called Talmud Bavli. And this is how Halivni goes to explain throughout his ideas, to say how they put it together. And he says, listen, the Stamayim, he always compares the work of the Stamayim to the work that they did on the fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you ever see the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Gniza, there is a very cool site called Gnazim. In Gnazim, they did computer, because you realize that when they went to the Gniza, there were fragments from all over. So they created an algorithm to pair those fragments, to realize that the fragments are really part of a paper. But there's a big hole always in the paper, right? Because if you put the fragments, you have the fragment on the left-hand corner and the lower hand, the right corner, but everything else in between. So they have to start the guesswork of making up what's in between to fill the gaps. And there is a whole industry of filling the gaps. And they try to do their best. If you ever see the work done by the what's called Dead Sea Scroll scholars, it's a fascinating work of filling the gaps. He says the Stamayim did the same thing. They had the apodictic statements of the Amoraim kept, put in Sugyot, missing the dialectics, the discussions. Some people remember, but they were informal remembrances. They were something very informal, and they had to reverse engineer and to fill the gaps. And many times they had no other choice than have something very forced to fill the gap. So in other words, so that the filling the gap wasn't like a smooth work, was actually a little forced. And that's forced interpretations. Now, this is Halivni. Now, the problem is that this is, in some ways, I even tell them, outlandish. First of all, Stamayim. You tell me that somebody in the 20th century found out a whole bunch of people who lived for 170 years. Nobody knows. Now, the question is, how does he do with Ravashi? The Gemara never says that Ravashi was the editor of the Bavli. It doesn't say that. That's Halevi. The Gemara says, Ravina veRavashi sof Horah. They are the end of Horah. What is Horah? Horah, he says, are the predictive statements. Horah is the teachings, the rulings. They finished the rulings, they are not the last ones, continued for a while. But his school was the end of the statements. The rulings and the statements, that's why it doesn't say that Ravina and Ravashi were the end of the Bavli. It says Ravina and Ravashi were the end of teaching, Horah, rulings. But they didn't do any. It says the Bavli, the ones who tried to put it together and to make sense of it together and to give, to fill in the gaps were the Stamayim. But sometimes it's not that easy. They had to. But the problem is, you tell me that nobody talks about the Stamayim? Rav Shir HaGoyen lived in the year 1000. So it's right 200 years afterwards. He doesn't remember them, who they were. Doesn't mention a word about the Stamayim. Not only that, who are the, according to Halivni, the Saboraim, that Rav Shir HaGoyen talks about the Saboraim? Who are the Saboraim according to Halivni? They are the sages, Rav Acha Meshabcha and Rav Shimon Kaira, who lived in the year 770. Rav Shir HaGoyen says the Saboraim lived in the 6th century already. Not only that, Rav Shir HaGoyen lists a lot of people. Rav Eina, Rav Simona, all kinds of names of people of Saboraim, that according to Halivni, they were not Saboraim, because Saboraim is much later. They are not Amoraim either, because the Amoraim is mentioned by name. So he is a problem, because he takes people who Rav Shir HaGoyen says are very important, he makes them inexistent because these people of Simon and Ravena, they're not mentioned anywhere else. Maybe they're the Stamaim. And he makes a whole category of people. And that is a problem. The problem is that you see something like this, that is a problem. So the question is, the Stamaim, not only that, we know that the Gemaras are different. We know, I told you, the five Masechtot Mishnah, the five odd Masechtot. If the Stamaim were doing it, why are they different? So he says, yes, because the Darim was the first one that they did, so it wasn't so good because you were developing the system. So that was the first try. Okay, or maybe later, he has different choices on that. The problem is, also, if the Amoraim didn't preserve the traditions, the discussions, who were the Stamaim? Who made the decision, okay, we're going to preserve that? It's such a very, very almost artificial break that after the Moraim, they started to preserve. And the biggest problem is that the anonymous strata exists on the Yerushalmi. And the Yerushalmi, everybody knows, is way before. So the Stam existed. You tell me that the Stam is some invention that came out in the 6th century by the Stamaim. The Yerushalmi had it. And clearly the Bavli did not know all the Yerushalmi, but knew about the Yerushalmi. So I think that this construction is extremely forced and in some ways, perhaps, fanciful. But one thing I can tell you, a few things that he said are truth, and they are really, you'll see, that you can't argue. The idea that there is a difference between the apodictic statements and the stammer, you see that everybody agrees with us. And this is something fundamental in the Bavli, that the Bavli is two works, the apodictic statements and the Stam. Who did the Stam and how did it come about? We're going to argue, but we're going to see now in the sources. Let me show you the sources. Says the Gemara in Eruvin. And this Raya, he brings himself, Halivni, in the Aflamet Beis Amud Beis. Says like this, the Mishnah, Nosnu be'ilon lemala me'asarat tfachim. If you put the Eruv on a tree above 10 tfachim, ein Eruv Eruv. The Eruv doesn't work. Lemata, Eruv Eruv, has to be below 10 tfachim. If it's too high on the tree, it's not an Eruv. Yesiv v'rabchia baraba v'rabasi v'rova barnosa v'yoster v'nachem gabayu. Rav Chia, Barava, and Rav Asi, and Ravova Bar Noson were sitting, and Rav Nachman was sitting with them. V'yosef v'kame, they were discussing about the Mishnah. Ha Ilan de Koyecha, where is that Ilan, this tree, that has to be below 10 tfachim, not above, where is it standing? Ilema de Kai Birshusayochid, if it's standing in somebody's house, the tree, and that's what the Eruv is, the Eruv Tchumin, Malilemala, Malilemata. Who cares if it's above 10 Tfochim, below 10 Tfochim? Doesn't make a difference. Rishut Ayachid, Ola Adarakia. Rishut Ayachid, a private property, captures still heaven. There's no difference between Lemalamim. Evala de Kaibir Shusarabim. Now, must be the tree standing in Shusarabim. That's why if it's above 10 Tfochim, you can't take it down. The Miskav Lish Bosecha. Where is the guy planning to stand? If he planned to be on top of the tree, the guy says, I'm going to be my place to stand to count the Eruv is on top of the tree. What's the problem? It tells me that you're trying to stay on the ground and to say I could use the Eruv which is on the tree because I could take it out if it's below 10 tfachim. You're not allowed to use the tree. So the Gemara was stuck. Le'oilam, the Gemara answers like the koi birshusarabi. They decided this is birshusarabi. We discover lishbo is lemata and is down, and you're planning to stay down. Ve'rebi him, and according to the sheet of Rebbe, the Omer Kodova shubishpus lagozul labinashmoshes, that because it's only the rabbanon that you can't take it off from the tree, you're allowed to do it. So it's talking about that the tree was standing in birshusarabi, the eruv was at below 10 tfachim, and the person was standing here. And he says, I'm going to use this Eruv, even though it's on a tree, technically you're not allowed to take something from the tree on Shabbos, on Ben HaShmoshes, you're allowed to. Now pay attention. Omeru Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman told him, Yashar, this is a real Terutz. V'chen Omer Shmuel, and I heard the same thing from Shmuel. This interpretation of the Mishnah, it's the right interpretation, Rav Nachman told him, and I heard it from Shmuel, which is the first Amora. Omru lei patritu bakule hai. Say, if you went through all the discussion, hinu namika patribo, So in other words, you're telling me that we had the discussion, they had the discussion, what's the difference? He's saying Rav Shmuel also had the discussion. Why are you trying to validate? El ach yomru li. That's what they asked him, Rav Nachman. Kabayisula b'gemara? Should we put this interpretation in the Gemara? Amar lohu, Rav Nachman told them, yes, in. So you see, they asked him, our interpretation, is it good enough to be established in the Gemara? And that Rav Nachman said, yes, and I heard from Shmuel also. So you could put it in the Gemara. Itmar nami, and this is what says, Omar Rav Nachman, it says as a statement, Omar Rav Nachman, Omar Shmuel, Ochabila noimit birshus arabim askinan. And the Mishnah is talking about Aila and birshus arabim, gavu asara v'rachavar, v'mitzka v'rishmamata v'rebihi. So you see, b'feirush, that when there was a discussion, there wasn't enough. Rav Nachman told me that's good enough. And he says, if it's good enough, can we put this in the Gemara to preserve? He says, yes. And how did they preserve? As a statement. Omar Rav Nachman, Omar Shmuel, discover lemata. You see, clearly in the time of the Moraim, there was a channel where they preserved traditions as an apodictic statement. And that's good for the Gemara is trying to tell you. They were discussing pshat in the Mishnah. Rav Nachman was standing with them, and he told that this pshat is good. And they said, what's afkimina if it's good? And he says, Shmuel also said, because they asked him, is it good enough to preserve in the Gemara? And Rav Nachman told him, yes, that's good enough. And it transformed from a story to a statement. Omar Rav Nachman, Omar Shmuel, Ocha Be'ilan, Ha'ibu B'shos Arabim, Gavu Asara, Vishkamat Be'rebihi. You see, Be'feirush, that Netav de Moraim, the stories, so one second, but the story is in the Gemara. What is he saying? The story is, they asked Rav Nachman, should we put it in the Gemara? And Rav Nachman said yes, and they turned it into a statement. But one second, the story is in the Gemara also. Says Halivni, it's very different. The Gemara that we have is not the original, the proto-Gemara. The proto-Gemara was ideas that were memorized as statements. And therefore, they wanted to know, this story, is it good enough to turn it into a statement? Rav Nachman says, Yosher, yes it is. So you see, that the statements of the Moraim were preserved into something which is called Gemara in the time of the Moraim. I think that this is an amazing raya, people. You see that the Gemara that we have, they are two strata. And you see something very cool now. And you see that the Achronim and the Rishonim, everybody believed this. People, until Halivni opened our eyes, we always learn the Gemara, and for us it's a chulent. It's all the same, anonymous, non-anonymous, it's the Gemara. I love the Arskro. The Arskro says, the Gemara says. And it sounds like, who's the Gemara? Here is a story that to put it in the Gemara, you had to get authorization by the Moraim and turn into a statement. It's not so simple. The Gemara is made of many layers, many strata. Let me show you something very cool, those two rayas, the Yad Malachi. Od hevi mikisve rav, this chamalach in tafyud. Shekose vezeloshoini. Venireli, the dafka ke de moira baletaret miyose. The Gemara says like this. The Gemara Shabbat says that if an Amora discusses about an opinion, is a raya that he holds of that opinion. There's a machloikis in the Mishnah. And an Amora comes to discuss and ask kashas on one opinion, it's a prima facie, it's a raya that he holds like that opinion, because otherwise, why would he waste his time discussing about something that's not halacha? Says the Chavos Yoyer, this is only a Moraic statement. Mashinkin stoma de Gemara. But if the stoma de Gemara argues or discusses about an opinion, there's no proof that he holds like that opinion. Darka lehakshus uletaretz. The stoma, he asks, when he's anonymous, it asks, and he gives the rutzim, afilo de lokil chasa, even though he doesn't hold of the halacha. This idea, there is a presumption that the discussion of an opinion means that you hold like that opinion, only holds water and holds true when Amoraim are discussing about Amoraim. If the Stama de Gemara discusses about an opinion, there is no presumption if it holds like it or not. Kmo shekosav atois bo metzia, now, so that's what the Chavos Yoyer says. Says the Yad Malachi, Hashem knows, when I saw what the Chavos Yoyer wrote, I trembled. Diminolam. How does he know that? The mishum de stoma de talmuda u de betaretz aliba de rova mishum achvet atzvidu lakilchasa. That if the stoma is arguing or interpreting, it interprets even something that's not halacha. What's the difference between an Amora that you hold the presumption he holds like him? The Stoma de Talmud, that the Stoma de Talmud lafa moirahu? The Hayad Malachi asks, one second, the Stoma is also Moraim. How do you distinguish between the two? Rabbi said, the Chavosior is telling you they are not the same. Functionally, they are different. Clearly, this is it. So you see, the Machloikis, if the Stoma de Gemara is a totally different construction, is Machlok is the Chavis Yoyer and the Yad Malachi. Now look at the reef. This reef is an amazing reef. In the Gemara goes and Rav Chulin, Rav Metzui Mesel Shchita Mumchina, and the Ken Yelchesa. The Ika Merabavta Man the Svira Le Keravina. The Svira Bilish Nakama. Avali Beid Yodim Elucha Shchita Im Lav Lo Ishchit. Ravina holds that no. If somebody does not know Allah as a shchita, should not do shchita. And therefore, if you have somebody that made shchita, you have to give him a test if he knows the Allah as or not. Im yodea ilcho shchita muta lechol v'im lavosar. If he knows Allah as, you're allowed to eat from him, if no, not. Okay? V'kaomri daril chasake ravina mishum debasro. And he holds, ravina is the last one of the Amoraim. The halacha always follows like the last one. Since Ravina holds that you need to check somebody if he knows Ilchot Shechita or not, that's the halacha. So we don't pass in Roiv Mitzuyim because there is a klal that we have a presumption that if you do a Shechita, you know the halacha. You don't have to ask him questions. Ravina holds not like that, and Ravina is the last one. Says the Rif, Ve'anan lo svira lanachi. We don't agree with those Rabavta. We agree, we are of the opinion, if anybody does Shechita, you don't have to ask him halachas. Why? He's against Ravina. Achi kaimalan de rov metzui mister Shechita mumchimem. We pasken not like Ravina, and we assume that anybody who does Shechita is a mumche. The hachin maskoma de gemara, because this is the stoma de gemara, mimbosa Ravina, after Ravina. So you see, beferush, that the Rif holds that the stam is after Ravina, which is the last one in the Gemara, and makes a big nafkimin al halacha. If you have an argument between the Stam and the Moraim, says the Rif, even the last Emora predates the Stam. So you see the Halivni's idea of the Stam being different, the Stam being later, is not Halivni's. Is the Rif, if anybody asks you, is the Stam the same, the Gemara, Ravina, Ravashi? No, the Rif says if there's a machloikis between the Stoma and Ravina, who do we pass like? The Stam, because the Stam is later. And the way and the approach of, it says the Chavos Yoyer, how the Gemara, the Amoraim approach, and the approach of the Stam is different. The Stam does his own way. And the question is, if that is the case, who is the Stama? If there are no Stamaim, you're going to see next week, I'm going to show you from Mekubalim, Alpi Kabbalah, there is three distinctions. Tanaim, Amoraim, and Savaroim. Who is the Stam? If it's after Ravina, who are they? It's after Ravina, the last one. Ravashi and Ravina, Sova Talmud, Isor, Rav Shira Goyen, Ravina is the end of the Talmud. And the Stam is later. Who is the Stam? Why is the Stam different? Different language. Tentative. Why there are so many forced interpretations? The questions are there. And this is something that we're going to explore in Brit Hashem next week. But before we go there, just we start a little late, I'm going to take 5 extra minutes just for us to be ready for next week. We know that the Gemara was oral. At least in its inception was oral. Like, there is a very famous article which are now translating, and I would encourage everybody to read, even though the article is over 100 pages, and with all the footnotes, makes it a 300-page article, but is the seminal article on the orality of the Bavli, called by Professor Zussman. Professor Zussman is an interesting guy. He also was an ex-Hevener. He learned in Hevener Yeshiva, And he was the head of the Talmud department at Hebrew University. And he wrote a famous seminal article called Torah Shebal Peh Pshuta Kimashma. Torah Shebal Peh means as you hear. It was oral. To prove the Bavli was oral, and you're going to see when was the Bavli first written. But you see, Professor Elman Zichronor Vracha just passed away, which mentioned in his name. He says, you see the Bavli's oral. The Gemara says, Ika de Amri. They are those who say. They don't say those who write. It's those who say. Right? You never have in the Gemara that they bring you a written text. They call the Tana. And they ask the Tana. But never they bring a written text. There's no such a thing. Look at the Gemara. When you quote a Braita, how are the Braita quoted? Tane Tana Kamei Derova. The Tana recited the Braita in front of Rava. So you see, Beferish, the Braitas are recited. They're not read. Tane Tana Kamei. Look at the Gemara. The Gemara has all these simonim. Simonim, simon, tada. What's the simon? The simon are mnemonics, for you to remember the way how this thing is put together. The Gemara Basra. The Gemara Basra talks about the signature of the Amoraim. The signature of the Amoraim are people who are not, if you realize, they are pictographs. If anybody sees, if you could go, by the way, to Hebrew University in Yerushalayim, and you could see signatures. And the signatures, the Gemara says, right, they were boats, they were pictures. Because it's not a literate society. These drawings as signatures of people who had to do it because most people didn't know how to read. So the Bavli was oral. And Professor Elman says, look at the Stam. The Stam of the Gemara for sure is oral. Even though it's later, it's still oral. Why? You look at, they are chiastic. The numbers, the numerology, and you could ask Michael, you darshan every number. It's always 3, 6. It's very, very almost artificial, the numbers, to allow you to remember. Okay? Not only that, the Stam of the Gemara, I told you, the 200 words, it's the same terminology. Is because it's oral and remembered. So people had a few words to remember. They're like key words to remember. The first evidence, we have no evidence of a written Bavli before the end of the 8th century. You're going to see that the Bavli was written at the end of the 8th century, in the year probably 770. And we're going to see next week, Mirtz Hashem, I'm going to bring you the next class, maybe it's next week, we have to discuss. Sefer Eitim says that Rav Nitrunai, going the Talmud of Yudai, going the 8th century, wrote the Bavli by heart and he sent to Spain. We are going to see that the Bavli was oral and was transmitted orally for a long time. And even when it was written, when they asked Rav Shira Goin, do you have written texts? And you're going to see Rav Shira Goin in the 11th century says, Girsa Islan Nuskhe Leslan. We have oral versions, we don't have written versions. The Bavli, at the earliest that we have, there was one Bavli that was found on Masechet Chulin that was written as a scroll. How do we know that it was a scroll? You know why you know it's a scroll? You realize that a codex is a notebook. Before the invention of the notebook, they were written as a scroll. We know there was a scroll because there are holes where this thing was stitched together. So you realize that Chulin was in the hole. So some people want to say that this is very early because in the 8th century they had codices, they had already notebooks. But as you'll see next week, that the people is the big expert on Chulin is the one in the one professor in the University of North Carolina in Chapel in the of South Carolina in Chapel Hill. He also says this is a different reason. This is much later. We don't have, after all the digging that we do, we don't have a Bavli written before the 8th century. Even Rav Shira Goin, right? In the 10th century, you have a Gemara, he says, that's 200 years old. They didn't have. Before that, the Bavli was written orally. Rashi Bob Metzia Daf Lamed Gimel Amud Aleph, and we'll see next week, I'm just giving you an introduction. Rashi says that in the later generations, they wrote, the Tukei Sofrim says, that Rashi writes, not in the later generations they wrote the Bavli, but he says in our days, Bedoroisenu, in our generations, they wrote the Bavli. So the Girsa that most people have, that Rashi is saying that in his time, the Bavli was written. And Rashi is the year 11th century, 1035. But clearly the Bavli is not. And therefore, when we learn the Bavli, we realize that we are learning a oral work. And we have to see how the work and when it was in its oral form, how it was learned, how it was transmitted, and how it became to be. So have a great night. Emir Hashem will continue for the final class.